You know what order you're going in?
We'll go along with the order we're in.
But you will announce who's pulling.
Yeah, well, that's the order. Oh, okay. Which ones we're pulling? Only one, right?
Right.
Ready? Call the House Healthcare Committee together to order, and together, I hope, whichever. Let me make a couple of announcements first. First, if you're here for House Bill 2174, we're carrying that bill over. There's some more work on an amendment that we're working on. So that bill will not be heard today. We're going to move some of the Ways and Means today, so we'll do some action. I want to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3137, simply for the purpose of saying where we're going. As some of you know, Senate Bill 99 has been working in the Senate on the health care exchange, and we decided that it would be useful to be hearing it in the House to make sure House members have a chance to talk about that bill. And we'll start actually with a work session on Friday of this week. Is that right?
Correct.
The purpose of Fridays is to go over one of the amendments in the form it's in now, but we'll be working it more, and we'll be doing invited testimony. So if you want to be testifying on the bill as we begin to work it, please check in with the administrator, and we'll keep a list and make sure folks who want to testify on it will. I think we'll be starting with the version of the Dash 2 amendments out of Senate Bill 99, which would be the Dash 1s for House Bill 3137. And we'll have that available before the work session on Friday. It'll be basically the Dash 2s with some stuff on brokers changed a bit. And that, I've been assured it will be available before we work it on Friday. So check in. The usual list of characters will make it available as you as it's ready, and check in with Sandy on that too. Okay, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3137 and open up an informational meeting entitled Getting Ahead of the Healthcare Cost Curve. We've given a modest time to three witnesses, and I would be happy to have them talk to us. We've been talking to different people who have ideas about how to save costs in the healthcare field, and these young gentlemen, who includes my constituent Michael Beaker, who was in addition my opponent in the last general election. We had a very nice campaign, I think. Well, it was nice because I won, but maybe
put that nice.
Maybe we should eliminate the editorial comments here around.
Mr. Beaker, will you guide this presentation? You have 20 or 25 minutes.
Sure. Can you hear me okay? All right.
Fine.
Well, just to give you a little bit of background of the three people that will speak today, is collectively the three of us.
Please introduce yourself.
Oh, sorry. Mike Beaker. The three of us have spent roughly 50 years helping healthcare providers navigate the complexity of today's healthcare environment. Graham Baumgartner, who is Chief Executive Officer of Exultant Consulting, is also a former chapter president of the Healthcare Finance Management Association, an organization of 35,000 healthcare professionals, including CFOs, controllers, and accountants. And Spencer and I have experience working directly for various providers, and currently we represent the consulting agency of Apex Health Advisory Group. Not many people in their lifetime have the privilege of presenting in front of a legislative body, and so I'm truly grateful to all the people who made this happen, in particular Representative Thompson, Representative Greenlick, and Sandy, especially Representative Greenlick for having a not holding things against me. But our hope is today's presentation will help give the House Healthcare Committee information on a rapidly growing segment of today's Oregon patient population, those with a high deductible health insurance plan. Additionally, we hope you'll agree with the conclusions we've drawn and become an advocate for transparency to help this growing segment be able to use its health insurance product more effectively. We'll provide some ideas as to what can be done, how these steps will decrease individual family costs, and even how care may be improved as a result. Since household expenditures on health care already exceed those on housing, I'm certain you'll support helping the Oregon family reduce their out-of-pocket costs. Now, as you probably know, a high-deductible health plan is one in which the patient must pay for the first $1,200 to $20,000 of his or hers or family's health care services for the year prior to insurance kicking in. Since these plans shift risk from the insurance company to the patient, these plans have lower monthly premiums than traditional plans and are frequently supplemented by tax-advantaged medical savings accounts. In other words, the monthly premiums are cheaper for these high-deductible health plans. And currently, high-deductible health plans account for 12% of the overall private insurance market. Now, our state, due to, and we'll go to the first graph here, the 12% is the bigger of the pie charts, and again, that represents the percent of Americans with a high-deductible health plan. Now, our state, due to leaders on this committee, has been a leader in advocating for transparency for individuals in the insurance market, and I think everyone in this room supports this. Roughly 6% of insured Americans purchase private insurer outside of an employer. So that's the small of the pie graph. So 6% purchase their private insurance outside of an employer. Now, with the adoption of the insurance exchange and the elimination of pre-existing condition clauses, more Oregonians will have access to become health insurance shoppers, maybe companies too, and this percentage is likely to grow, that 6%, as citizens in our state will be able to determine easily and quickly if they can get a better deal from purchasing insurance outside of their employer. But while the state of Oregon has been a leader in advocating for transparent information regarding health insurance costs, we believe it is also important to give consumers access to direct costs they can expect for health care services beyond the subset of inpatient charge information that is available on OregonPricePoint.com. Now, unfortunately, individuals like myself who have a high-deductible health plan have an extremely difficult time acquiring upfront prices for care needed from providers and or insurance company. As a result, high-deductible health plan enrollees like myself can typically only research prices of prescription drugs ahead of time. So a month and a half ago, my oldest son, Henry, my wife and I have two young little boys, and my oldest is 3 years old. He woke up, and one of his eyes was a tad pink. As fairly new parents who on the pendulum of very concerned, relaxed, lean more towards the concerned side, we were both nervous that his pink eye could be pink eye. Unfortunately, there was no currently tools that exist to let me check what the price would be to take my son to the urgent care by our home, to St. Vincent's Emergency Department, or the clinic nearby our home. When we called providers, they told us we need to work with our insurance company to figure out what we'll eventually have to pay towards our high-deductible health plan. When we called my insurance company, after working through various automated prompts and being shuffled around to a couple live voices, I finally spoke to one individual who blanketly told me that it depends how the encounter is coded and wouldn't release any rate information to me. Now, my family couldn't tell where we could get the best deal or even get an estimate of the out-of-pocket responsibility. And we certainly couldn't rudimentally gauge if the out-of-pocket was going to be so high that it may be worthwhile to Google WebMD the issue, try some over-the-counter remedies for a day first. Now, we ended up going to urgent care. We found out a month later it cost $200. But anyway, most health care encounters, including inpatient stays and surgeries, are planned for. And unfortunately, the current offerings of data and tools available for making healthcare decisions are less than desirable. Providers and payers are currently ill-prepared to respond to consumer price inquiries, and long wait times and inconsistent responses plague most interactions.
Sorry, we're working with slow technology here. I'm Spencer Bailey. I'd like to thank you guys for letting us speak as well. Thanks, Mike. And as you just learned, participation in high-deductible health plans shifts financial risk onto patients who must bear the out-of-pocket costs until a deductible is met. By all accounts, we expect that this group will grow in the coming years as healthcare costs continue to increase. Employers are looking for ways to defer increasing health care costs onto employees and are steering more and more employees into high deductible plans or high out-of-pocket plans. The individual mandate, as Mike said, for health insurance will disproportionately favor an increase in high deductible products as well. And insurance exchanges and guaranteed insurability will improve transparency between health insurance products. So those people who can get a better deal outside of an employer-sponsored plan may opt for a lower monthly premium associated with a high deductible health care product. So as you can see, the demand for pricing transparency, those upfront costs associated with a patient encounter will increase as the participation in high deductible health plans grows. These individuals will want more information about the amount they should be expected to pay upfront for health services. And most importantly, the lack of pricing information may limit access to health services, similar to the other access issues that face the uninsured population today.
My suggestion is, if you have a solution to this, you start on the solution.
We're getting there.
You have almost half your time.
Sure. I think we can actually, by all accounts, this population is expected to grow, and that's really the point that we wanted to make. And really, by the year 2020, health industry experts expect that the high deductible population will hit about 60% of the total insured population. So it is expected to be very significant. We can move along to the next slide. And really, the goal is instilling market incentives into, one, price transparency assists the Oregon consumer in being able to compare against providers what the out-of-pocket expense will be. But most importantly is that market efficiency and price comparison tends to hold down costs for health services over the long term. Good example is when you compare services paid out-of-pocket. For example, LASIK surgery here.
Now, 9 minutes into your 15 minutes, which might go to 20. If you have a solution to this problem, you don't have to convince us. We understand.
Okay.
It.
Okay. Well, we can. Maybe we'll skip to the recommendations then.
That's a good idea.
Okay. So really, again, enhanced pricing transparency, and that may seem pretty straightforward in the healthcare industry. It's a little bit more complex. And really, what there's four key points in terms of recommendations that we'd like to make. The first is regarding stated price transparency, which is the price that providers of health services have as their stated price for a given service. It's something that most states have embraced in some form, and really it's just a publishing the stated price for all providers for services. Really what that doesn't do is tell you what the out-of-pocket expense would be for someone that's covered under insurance. So most health insurance providers negotiate rates with providers under a contract. That contract is typically a discount off of the stated price, which is recommendation one. We also recommend that that we hold providers accountable to disclosing their prices net of a contractual allowance, the amount that the insured under a high deductible plan would ultimately pay. So that's the recommendation number two.
Grant Baumgartner, now speaking, CEO of Exalton, the healthcare consulting firm. So we just presented our first two recommendations. Number one, price transparency for all healthcare providers at basically a retail basis. Number two, pricing for the particular insurer that you have. Okay, two different factors. If I go get a doctor's visit, the retail price for that doctor's visit may be $150. If I have insurance with, say, Regents, they have a contract with that provider, the price to me will be what Regents is contracted for. It may be $120, for example. Those are the first two recommendations. The third recommendation, we are recommending that the legislature consider requiring healthcare providers to provide an estimate of total charges and patient out-of-pocket costs for any service that a healthcare consumer requests, okay, so that they will know ahead of time what their out-of-pocket costs will be, whether that will be a deductible, a co-insurance for a particular service. There is one nearby precedent set on this issue. The state of California has that requirement in their law. In that case, it's just for uninsured patients for hospital services, but we're recommending that this be broadly applied to any person for any health care service, again, to protect the consumer, for those with high deductible plans to know exactly what a service will cost them so that they can make the most cost-effective decisions and ultimately hold providers accountable, more price competitive, and ultimately reduce costs and prices to the Oregon healthcare consumer. That's our third recommendation. Our final recommendation is that the legislature required standard charging methodologies for healthcare providers. And again, like the third recommendation, this is to assist consumers be able to actually cost-consciously shop for healthcare services and compare services. So let me give you a quick example of how difficult it can sometimes be to shop for healthcare services. If I'm going in, a couple years ago I had a Achilles tendon repair surgery. If I go to a freestanding surgery center, they usually or frequently will have one price for that service, and that's it, pretty cut and dry. If I try to get that service at a hospital outpatient department, they may charge me frequently per minute of surgery time, plus other charges for medical supplies, pharmaceuticals, etc. So it's very difficult to compare the exact same service at two different providers. So example of that, again, the suggestion that you consider developing standard charge methodologies for hospital pricing.
Sure. You have a question?
Yeah, I'm very interested in what you're describing. I think you put your finger on a real problem. I wonder if you've had a chance to look at what insurance companies are required to do in the state of Oregon as a result of the passage of House Bill 2213 in 2007. And I'll read from the press release that DCBS issued, the insurance division issued after that bill went into effect. It says, a law passed by the Oregon legislature in 2007 required insurance companies to provide their members with out-of-pocket cost estimates for common medical procedures through an interactive website and toll-free phone number no later than July 1st, 2009. Insurers must provide estimates for the five most common procedures in each of these categories: office visits, radiology, laboratory, uncomplicated birth, immunizations, orthopedics, digestive system, endoscopy. So I worked on this bill. Chair Greenlick worked on this bill. I think we may be the only two surviving members of that healthcare committee. But it's out there. And maybe it doesn't get at everything that you're describing here.
Right.
But I think it gets at quite a bit of it.
Yeah. I think that's our position would be, first of all, we think that is something we applaud that. We're suggesting it go a step further to for all procedures, basically. For example, the top five procedures that are performed may not be what I need next type of thing. And I know it's difficult, but that's what we're suggesting.
Mike, you said you spent your time doing coding.
Sure.
How many different procedures would an insurance company need to have listed for the number of plans they have?
No doctor, at least that I know of, does their bill on a piece of paper. They're all using computer systems. They all have prices, and they do electronic bills. That information can be at easily. It can be put up either on their own website, or if there was a state database where we wanted to be able to compare simple outpatient procedures by a procedure code or a CPT code, you could be able to do that. Now, one of the theories that a lot of people say is that providers keep their prices opaque as a way to keep prices up. So they're not going to willingly release this information, even though it's easily accessible. They all use computers. They all have a list of procedures and prices. But to that point, that if there had Is there any website right now where I can go and say, you know, can I compare for simple outpatient procedures, common stuff that you and I go to, get a son checked out for a pink eye type visit, that I can compare, you know, the physician practice right by down our street, the urgent care, the hospital.
But you said common. We actually, I'm sure we all agree with your point.
Sure.
That's why I was cutting you short. We have a bill in front of us right now to do exactly that in the doctor's office. But the objection we've gotten from the providers is that that represents 1,000 or 2,000 different procedures. I mean, you said common procedures, but that's not what you asked for. You asked for all procedures.
Yeah, let's get it all.
Times their deal with various insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, each doctor would have to produce an astronomical book of data. They're arguing. I mean, how do you respond to that?
Did you want to take this one?
Sure. First of all, we're... all of our clients, we fully realize, would advocate that. We're here kind of on behalf of the consumer. Again, I'd give a similar answer to what Mike just suggested, and that is that these days, all those algorithms are essentially computerized. While it would, let's be clear, would mean some more resources for them in terms of people to man the systems and just respond to punch in the computer algorithms for each service, but it can be done. It's relatively automated, and we think, again, should be done for the healthcare consumer to make cost-conscious choices.
And it's the direction the industry is going. You saw that it's 12% of Americans have a high deductible health plan as their private insurance, and that's projected to grow up to 60% of the private insurance pie by 2020 by many healthcare futurists. So it's the direction the industry is going, and given the information, access to that information, whether it's on the health insurance exchange, if they're comparing buying United versus Blue Cross versus Kaiser, seeing what their favorite doctor, Dr. Barry's, what their office visit would cost for them between their insurance plans, as well as the monthly premium, or just common services for the providers that are local to their house.
Other questions to these gentlemen?
May?
Yes, Senator Thompson.
I can see in theory how this might work, but one of the problems I think you're going to run into is you don't always know what you're shopping for, and there won't be a price. I mean, if I have, you know, lower abdominal pain and I want to go to the doctor, there may be a standard office visit fee that we can talk about, but the rest of it is going to be based on the CPT codes for individual tests, x-rays, whatever the doctor wants to run to diagnose my problem. So you're going to have a whole range of things. I don't know how you could get an estimate because it's going to depend what the package is, and at the same time, you don't want to pay for a package, some of the service of which you're not going to receive because the doctor decides you don't need it. So you can't go with the, here's what the whole package looks like, but you only need this part, and you can't go with, here's what the doctor's office charge is, but then you need some of this part too. I don't see how you get an estimate out of that until the job is done.
It would be interesting to know, though, if he says you need a CAT scan, how much that CAT scan is going to cost you.
It would, yeah. But that's kind of, even if we get a price per CPT code, you're not going to know what the codes are that a doctor may require or suggest. I guess you can certainly say, I don't want that test, because I can get it cheaper somewhere else.
That's a challenge. I mean, medical necessity, you don't want to quote a price and then go over it. And I think, you know, states have worked on a variety of ways to control for that. And one is, like your lower abdominal pain example, having diagnoses, and then they use like a high-low mean approach. You know, there's a variety of ways you can go about it, but they've typically required that for a, because there is a lot of calculation that goes into it, historical claims data and things of that nature. So they typically only require top 25 diagnoses or things of that nature. But there is a format for that.
And just to add on, for something as big as healthcare expenditures in our country, 17-18% of GDP, household expenditures already exceed those on housing, what they currently cost in healthcare. I think swinging towards the area of transparency, and whether it's 10,000 procedures and prices, if I'm driving down my car down the road, I can compare Chevron to ARCO, the grade of gas, to the fraction of the penny. But in healthcare, it's currently operating as a black box. And with this growing population of patients that have high deductible health plan, I would rather see some more swings towards consumer transparency.
Wouldn't you want to know that in a, I mean, sort of like the gas price. It doesn't tell you how much it's going to take your car in to be fixed
right.
with 18 things. I mean, I think what you were looking for with your son was, how much is an officer going to cost?
Correct.
And I mean, this is very timely what you're talking about, because we literally have a bill in front of us right now where we're trying to turn in, as we did with the insurance bill, into a sort of modest approach. I mean, if I'm going to get knee surgery and it's at this hospital or at this hospital, how much are you, my insurance company, going to charge me with my, even with my 15%? I mean, we couldn't find that before. I think we now can find it. It's the same way with the doctors, as we've been thinking, well, if you get the main office visit, the follow-up visit, another dozen most common things, it would give most consumers the amount of information they need to begin to make a rational decision.
Yeah, you're right, and even if you had it by CPT code and you didn't know the myriad of CPT codes you could get, you'd at least have the information to compare afterwards after you look at your bill. Wow, I really got one pulled over me. I could have paid half the price going down the street at this other place.
I agree with what you're trying to do. My fear is that we'll get the kind of law that we have for hotels where the rack rate is posted on the inside of the hotel room door, and it's a price nobody in their right mind ever pays, you know, because it's the upper price if you're really stupid. And so it isn't going to be that helpful.
Fourth of July.
Yeah, and likewise, going back to your analogy on gas prices, you know, that's really nice and that's very simple, but what happens if your car gets towed into the garage? Gas may not be your problem. And now we're going to get out a whole bunch of new codes, you know, and hopefully you're just out of gas, but it could be a whole lot worse. So it's not, there's no simple, hey, if we have this one price, we got it made sort of thing in healthcare. And maybe there should be, but.
Yeah, I think that price should be, how much if I come in without insurance, are you going to charge me, period? Look, we do need to dismiss you. It's very timely.
Yeah.
Because I say we have a bill in front of us we're struggling with on exactly this point, but I think we all agree this notion of transparency,
yeah.
whether it's for high deductibles or only 20%. I mean, if I'm in PEB, my wife's getting hip surgery, she's going to pay 15% in net and 30% out in net for that. And if that's what we were paying, if we weren't in Kaiser, I want to know what difference it makes going here or there if I got 15% in the game or 30. Thank you very much.
Well, we appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I don't know if we leave it with the committee assistant. Yeah, we put together a lot more information on the topic we presented, and if you want us to present this to anybody else, we'd be happy to.
That'd be great, Mike. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Close the informational hearing. Let's go a little bit out of order and try and take the easy ones. We have some, I think, very straightforward work sessions. So why don't we go to the back? We have three work sessions that may be fairly easy to deal with. Let's try.
Which one are you going to?
We'll have a work session on House Bill 2394, which is headed to Ways and Means by prior reference, or
no.
Not necessarily by prior reference. We have to send it to Ways and Means.
Correct.
And let's see.
Do you want
will
me
you
to
tell us about that bill?
Sure, Mr. Chair.
Which bill?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2394 allows health professional regulatory boards to which monies in a fund or the account are continuously appropriated to spend without limitation. It specifies the percentage of monies in the fund or account for expenses related to conducted case hearings. You may recall that this is a bill that came out of a recommendation of the work group that Representative Coyle and the Governor's Office worked on. The couple of boards, the licensed social workers and the Board of Dentistry, came before the committee and outlined to the committee the advantages to having appropriations throughout to roll over their balances from annually to annually. This didn't have a reference to ways and means. It's indeterminate in its current form, but the percentage has to be determined, and that percentage is recommended that it be determined in ways and means, Mr. Chair.
Or if we put a number in it, it would then make it go to ways and means because it wasn't indeterminate.
Either way, correct.
We're
Mr.
in
Chair.
Catch 22.
Correct.
Representative Hoyle, do you want to comment on this at all?
Yes, this did come out of a work group. This was a recommendation from the boards, and again, the recommendation that we wanted to put in was 50% that they should be allowed to, that we should put 50% in, that should be allowed to roll 50% over. But again, as that would shoot it down to ways and means anyway, we figured let's just get it down there as quickly as possible, and we'll communicate with them and hopefully get this to the floor where we can vote on it because it's a good bill and should pass.
Any opponent? Any opposition to it?
None that I am aware of.
Okay. Any other discussion? How about a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2394 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 2394 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any further discussion? Please call the roll.
Yes.
Representative
Parrish?
Aye.
Representative Hoyle?
Yes.
Representative
Weider?
Absent.
Co-Vice Chair Cannon?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Kinnamer?
Aye.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Green.
Aye. Motion passes. On to Ways and Means. Okay. I will close the work session on House Bill 2384 and open
2394.
Mine's a terrible thing to lose. And open a work session on House Bill 2395. You want to guide us through that one, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2395 had a public hearing on February 16th. You may recall this is the bill that was regulating the use of the terms clinic, institute, and specialist by health professionals, had an emergency clause, and it declared and was effective on passage. You have a -2 amendment in front of you. It seems the folks that had concerns about this bill got together, and it actually ended up being that the terms clinic, institute, and specialist triggered more confusion than clarity. So the amendment takes out those trigger words and then connects it in a bigger umbrella for just the use of the title of doctor in connection with the healthcare profession at any time. The individual must designate the healthcare profession in which the individual's doctoral degree was earned, and it specifies for the written material, any advertisement, and it also clearly identifies when the title of doctor can be used. The folks that put this recommendation for the amendment together approve of the amendments. To the best of my knowledge, they haven't come up and said that they don't anymore, and we do have fiscal and revenues on the -2 amendment. There's no expenditure with the -2s, and there's no revenue impact with the -2s, Mr. Chair.
You think this is going to do it?
Well, we seem to do it every session, but we'll give this one a whirl.
Why don't we put a motion on the floor and look for comment then?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -2 amendments to House Bill 2395, dated 3/9/11.
Any objection to the motion? -2s are there. How about a motion on the bill as amended?
Mr. Chair, I moved House Bill 2395 with the -2 amendments as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Anybody out there with a problem with this thing? I don't want to hear about it again next time. We have a motion on the floor. Let's get a vote.
Representative
Jordan?
Aye.
Representative Parrish?
Aye.
Representative Coyle?
Yes.
Representative Weider?
Absent.
Co-Vice Chair Cannon?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Kinnamer?
Aye.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Raymond?
Aye. Motion passes. Anybody want to carry this? All right. I'll carry it.
You want to carry it?
I'll carry it. You got to come and help me.
I will.
Yeah. Close the work session on House Bill 2395. Open up a work session on House Bill 2908. Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2908 was brought before us by one of your fellow members, Representative Doherty. This bill prohibits a person from performing the pelvic exam on an anesthetized or unconscious woman unless the woman has given informed consent to the examination. The original bill created a Class A misdemeanor and was punishable by 1 year imprisonment or $6,250 fine. You have the Dash 1 amendments, which basically replaces the measure. It took out the Class A misdemeanor, put the enforcement mechanism into the regulatory licensing board, and that it also affords that a person authorized to make healthcare decisions for the woman has given consent to the examination.
Will that remove the subsequent to judiciary?
Yeah, this didn't have a subsequent to judiciary, Mr. Chair.
I thought that's what, no, that's
that
the next one.
That
okay,
was another
great.
Bill. Right, and we do have a fiscal and revenue impact on the Dash 1 amendment. Minimal expenditure on the Dash 1, no revenue impact on the Dash 1.
Would you like to comment on that?
No, I did. There were some questions that you had last time when I sent the questions out to you this afternoon.
Everybody?
This morning.
This afternoon?
Oh, this morning, nice.
You might want to just quickly run through those.
The questions that you had and the answers. Some of the questions that were brought up last time is are there any current statutes and informed consent laws regarding procedures that patients must approve? And basically it was there isn't really much in statute about informed consent. There is no ORS that provides a procedure for obtaining informed consent but doesn't state when a physician must obtain that informed consent. There are specific references to informed consent relating to sterilization and genetic testing, but that's about it. The second question is that when we were speaking with the DAs, the district attorneys, it seemed that if there was sexual intent, this would be covered under a number of the ballot measure or the Measure 11 statutes. Is there any criminal statute that covers it? And again, if you were, the basic answer is no. It would be considered harassment.
Great.
Sexual harassment.
Thank you. Is there any other discussion? Ready for a vote? We have an amendment?
Yes, we do.
A motion for the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2908, dated 3/17/11.
Representative Thompson's move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2908. Any discussion? Any objection? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2908 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 2908 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative
Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Harris?
Aye.
Representative Boyle?
Yes.
Representative Weiner?
Absent.
Vice Chair
Kinnear?
Aye.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenwald?
Aye. Motion passes. Representative Doherty, you carry that?
Please. Thank you very much.
And Doherty carrying it. Close the work session on 2908 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2366. You want to describe it?
Sure.
Representative Nathanson, will you join us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2366 was brought to the House Healthcare Committee at the request of Representative Nathanson. This is directing the Oregon Health Authority to develop programs to recruit medical school students, primary care residents, and primary care physicians to Oregon. Declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13. The need to refocus our resources and our investments in prevention and early treatment is great. The need for primary care professionals is great. I know that in other hearings and at other times you've received lots of statistics about what we need and what we don't have. And so I'm not going to repeat all those statistics and the rationale. I'll just say that it is critically important. I've been concerned about this for several years, and this bill is one small piece in what I hope is putting together a large effort to do something about it. Despite the warnings about the dire shortage of primary care physicians now and in the future, it feels like we still haven't been able to do very much about it. It's easy to see how that could happen. Given our budget constraints, we're unable to expand costly medical school programs to a great degree, and there's a limited federal allowance for residency programs. Some of the other important ideas that I know you've heard related to primary care range from reimbursement rates to loan repayment plans for medical school students. This plan, this proposal that I have, is much narrower. It's targeted. It's trying to take advantage of Oregon's assets, the lifestyle, the natural environment, and the healthcare environment to more actively market Oregon as an attractive place for primary care physicians to practice. I'd already been thinking about this, and then two unrelated visits to a local hospital really clinched my determination to come up with an idea to propose. First was a tour and a briefing I had at the emergency department at the Peace Health Riverbend Hospital. In a wrap-up conversation with the head of the emergency department, he said one of the most important things we could do to help the emergency department was to improve primary care. That was a key thing to hear from that person. In an unrelated, separate conversation, in a meeting I was having with the chief of staff, who was also a cardiologist, a specialist, he told me one of the most important things we need to do is improve primary care, and we need more primary care physicians. So we discussed the idea. I developed it with his encouragement, and we broadened the discussion to include hospital administrators and others involved in healthcare administration. This idea has two components. For both of those components, the idea would be that the Oregon Health Authority, working through the Health Policy Board Workforce Committee, would collaborate with the Workforce Investment Board in a totally different agency, medical schools, physician organizations, hospitals, county and city officials, chambers of commerce, Travel Oregon, and all those other organizations that are involved in recruiting or training primary care physicians. The first part of it is to develop materials that market Oregon as a desirable place to live and specifically targeted to this audience. Second, to create a pilot program to promote coordinated visiting and recruitment opportunities. Some of this goes on a little bit already in a particular community. You may have one or two organizations in a community say, let's get together and bring someone in. What isn't done, it appears, quite so much is to do this as a regional approach. Given the cost of bringing people in from a distance, and not only the cost to the local area, but the cost to that person to decide to travel all the way to Oregon, might not we have more people willing to travel to Oregon if they knew that they were going to visit two or three different communities in a region in the same week or over the same weekend? They might even be able to bring a spouse or some other family member to check out the opportunities. In other words, one plus one might be more than two. I've had a couple of very helpful conversations with the Oregon Health Authority, even as recent as this morning, but also over the last couple of months, and they have helped enormously in clarifying the intent of this bill. An amendment is being drafted. We just didn't have it back by the time we came into the meeting this afternoon, but the amendment is being drafted with the participation of the authority. It will indicate that the authority should be calling on the key partners who are already working on this type of activity, but separately, like AHEC, the Office of Rural Health, and others. The goal is to have an agency appointed as the convener of these discussions, but they would get together and come up with a plan, and together they will figure out specifically how to fund any of the activities in the plan. The idea was not to set up a whole new agency and a whole new staffing in our existing budget climate. It just seems, unfortunately, that the state currently lacks an integrated approach to this activity, and that's what this bill is calling for. You have a letter with, I believe you already have the letter today, from the Lane Workforce Partnership supporting this idea. I think that's interesting that the Workforce Partnership, not a healthcare agency, joins the healthcare advocates in appreciating the need, and they point out the implications for Oregon's economy as well. What the docs have told me is that doctors considering where to locate want a decent place to live and decent people to work with. Let's exploit the attractiveness of Oregon for living and working. Let's show them what Oregon has to offer. We need everybody who's in the business of recruiting to pull together. What we can do in a coordinated approach should far exceed what we've been doing in a diffused, dispersed, and independent fashion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
We'll be hearing from several of those people you talked about.
I hope so.
I expect we'll all be asking them the question is, how would this be different? How would you perceive this as being different from the various things we're doing now? So.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for bringing it. I'm going to stand at ease for a moment because we may want to take testimony from a senator who has to leave shortly. Hearing on House Bill 3580, which is what Senator Atkinson wants to testify on. And let's just hold on a moment. Your afternoon break, right?
Will you give me a good deal?
Yep. Hey, I'm practicing all kinds of things these days. Anything to make a buck, right?
Jeez.
So I will scrub the teeth for it. I keep spare toothpaste and floss upstairs. So no.
Back into order. I'd like Senator Atkinson to join us for House Bill 3580. And Grant, you want to join us?
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Jason Atkinson. I represent a good portion of Southern Oregon. I'm delighted to come and just give a bit of a personal reference on my support of House Bill 3580, and thank you, Chair and Co-Chair, for accommodating me. I will just say that there has been a big involvement, at least from my family, to a very small first responders unit in rural Lake County. That has been an absolute delight, something that I've been involved with. And we have gone from the tragedy of two people dying to a community of less than 40 getting together and raising enough money and enough awareness to have their own ambulance service. Six people have earned their EMTs. A place to lodge the new ambulance. And a real success story for a place in Oregon that a lot of people think is a typo. And now the issue becomes, as they stay up to speed, is training. And so when I was made aware of this, I first thought of the Warner Valley First Responders Unit and whether or not they would qualify for this type of training. And I believe that's the case. And yes, I was told walking in that they are interested. And for that reason alone, not to mention the other countless small communities that could be affected by this bill, I'd love to offer my support. And Mr. Chair, thank you for allowing me that time to put that on the record.
Is there a question, Mr. Senator? I have a question, perhaps Grant can get to it. Interestingly, at 1 o'clock, the Subcommittee on Human Services of the Ways and Means Committee addressed the budget of the public health group specifically around this issue and gave them a very difficult time with the suggestion that since this shouldn't be paid for by general funds, since the governor has zeroed out, it would be paid for by license fees. And there was a big resistance, maybe not to the notion of paying for it by license fees, but perhaps by the distribution of the fee itself. This was one of the things included in that. I take it you would support the notion of at least paying for this piece of the service, which is about $300,000, if I'm remembering correctly, $350,000 by general fees. I mean, I communicate between the two. Do you have
fees or funds? Did you mean to say funds?
It is currently funded by general funds.
Right.
The governor zeroed those out in his proposed budget. The department's proposal was to pay for it by fees across a variety of people who use it, specifically for this, but about $2 million or $3 million, I think, of this, which was $350,000. You have a sense of whether it ought to be paid for by general funds or other ways?
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, it's hard for me to weigh in on a hearing in ways and means that I didn't hear. However, my concern with an approach like that in prior experiences is that we start getting into very populated places that generate more fees, feeling like the smaller places don't pay their fair share and ergo shouldn't have the same amount. And that's a policy debate that we seem to have around here often. And in the small first responders unit that I'm talking about, that's been my privilege to be involved with, they would never qualify under any given ratio for any given help because they're just too small. And so I would be personally skeptical of going to a fee base, which I've seen go to a geography base, which seems to be the Solomon-esque thing around this building to do it by congressional district. I mean, you can just follow the symmetry train all the way down to rural Oregon not getting it. And so, you know, that may be an overreaction and maybe not fully appreciating the confines of the conversation, but that's my first reaction, Mr. Chair.
Helpful. Under the assumption that we'll pass this thing and send it on to Ways and Means, it would be useful for you to be leaving with it at that point.
Thank you.
Are there other questions? Senator Atkinson? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
Why don't we stay in this one, and then we'll go back to where we were before.
Great.
Co-chairs Green Lake and Thompson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the administrator of the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, Public Health Division, Oregon Health Authority, and one of the programs in my office is the Emergency Medical Services and Trauma Systems Program. One of the activities that we are responsible for is the mobile training unit, and as you know, this bill would direct $300,000 of general funds so that we could continue to provide that service. That service is providing education on site primarily to emergency medical services providers and agencies. We've been doing this now for over two decades in the Public Health Division. While it is a statewide resource, as Senator Atkinson was pointing out, it really has been directed towards rural and frontier EMS agencies, and the reason for that is that they have a disproportionate number of volunteers that are hard to get to training. They are the most financially strapped, and just they're geographically they're isolated enough that it's difficult for them to get to training. So the MTUs have been traveling across Oregon, like I said, for the last 20 years. They provide both lectures and experiential learning. They're involved in regional disaster drills. They do some simulation training. Actually, there's some really high state-of-the-art training that's going on there. And just as an example, from 2006 to 2009, the MTU provided over 2,000 hours of training, and that was to over 3,500 volunteers and 800 paid EMS professionals. And each MTU unit travels over, and this is historically over 20,000 miles every year to provide that training. Representative Greenleck mentioned the budget issue, and just to briefly go through the where we are with that right now. During this current biennium, in order to help fill some budget gaps, we actually discontinued one of the mobile training units. And at that time, there was a lot of hue and outcry that we not do that to the second one as well, so we kept the second one going. However, when we were building the budget with the previous administration, that second MTU was zeroed out as well. As Co-Chair Greenleck mentions, the Governor Kitzhaber in his governor's balanced budget suggested that the $2 million that we have in general fund that supports a variety of activities in EMS and trauma system program, that be backfilled with fees. And so today we had our first discussion with the Ways and Means Committee on funding programs through new increased fees on the industry, and at least the way I perceived what Co-Chair Bates asked the division to do was to get a group of stakeholders together, see if we could come to consensus on a fee increase that would be broad-based and which everyone could come to consensus on, and then also figure out what are the highest priority programs for EMS and Trauma Systems Program and decide which ones of those we were going to fund. So there is a possibility that through that process that we would have MTUs, either one or two, back in a budget, but right now that is very uncertain. I could not promise anything. So with that, I'll close and be happy to answer questions.
Yeah, I think it was even more negative than you defined it. Okay, let's go back. Thank you very much. I think we're doing fine with time today. Let's go back to House Bill 2366, which is still open. And invite, the first group, Lisa Dodson, Joe Johnson, and Janine Smith to the front. And next it will be Rose Cox, Brian Beringer, and Doug Riggs. And when we get back to 2385, we have two more folks here and three on the phone to address that. So we'll move as quickly as we can through these.
Do you want to go first? Do you want to go first? Go ahead.
Co-Chair Greenlake Ann Thompson, members of the committee, Janine Smith, the Administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research in the Health Authority. Thanks for inviting us to come and talk about 2366. The Health Authority and the Oregon Health Policy Board are keenly aware of the issues around workforce, having had it brought up as a key topic in all of the work over the last 2 years. And we did start up a permanent committee of the policy board called the Workforce Committee that you all inspired us to do, since you had it in House Bill 2009, as a key place to be a convener and integrator of information and policy recommendations by all the interested parties related to workforce. And it has completed its first set of reports, and the findings of primary care being a key aspect of what we need to be focused on, and that also relates now with the new work from the health transformation team that many of you are very aware of. But we want to make sure that the goals of this bill do not duplicate current efforts done by some great folks here in the state already, but need to, as Representative Nathanson pointed out, convene and align those efforts so that we can be more effective and efficient about them. So the Office of Rural Health has been doing a lot of work with rural communities and has a lot of opportunities. As you'll hear from Dr. Dodson about the Oregon Area Health Education Center, or AHAC, and its offices, the Physician Professional Service Societies, hospitals, health systems, and other healthcare employers have all been doing their own efforts. Communities as well have aligned to try to do this. We have in our office also some the J-1 visa program and some of the health profession shortage activities. All this, there's a lot going on, but in terms of trying to better align it. We feel that the Healthcare Workforce Committee of the Policy Board could be a convener of that, and with some, we've spoken with Representative Nathanson and her staff about how some of the language could be adjusted to ensure that this doesn't have a fiscal impact, since we are in tough budget times. But by convening the various partners who are all very eager and interested in this, working with entities even including the tourists, focused activities such as the travel Oregon folks. How could we all pool dollars, come up with an effective funding stream to develop those materials, to do that outreach, to encourage and bring in the physicians and attract them to Oregon, which is a great place to work and practice. And we've also heard from the Oregon Primary Care Association and some of their work and in the challenges that the safety net community also has in recruiting. And so how can we make sure that is also aligned? So we think that this is certainly workable, but we would encourage it to go through this committee that you have already set up to make sure that we're all the right people are at the table to make this work.
Thank you.
My name is Lisa Dodson. I am the director of the Area Health Education Centers program. I'm also serving on the Oregon Health Policy Board, a workforce committee, and on the Oregon Health Authorities Health Services Commission. I am here to speak in favor of Representative Nathan's bill with a few caveats and a couple of recommendations. As was mentioned, some increased focus and integration of those activities. The fact of the matter is that many people are working on these problems already, and unfortunately are often at cross purposes or even very competitive in the process. That is because there is a lot of private money that is being invested in this, as well as public money in the recruitment and retention of physicians. Just as an example, in 2009, the AHEC did a statewide survey of our critical access hospital system and found that more than 3/4 of the hospitals are actively recruiting for one or more physicians. Many of them are recruiting for many other health professionals at the same time. At least 60% of them are spending more than $50,000 annually on recruiting costs. And these are our smallest, most vulnerable hospitals, many of which are also supported with public dollars. 40% of our hospitals, critical access hospitals, reported that they were unable to satisfy their ability to arrange temporary coverage through things like locum tenens, which led to our starting the locum tenens program through the AHEC. And 30% of our our critical access hospitals said that they were unable to satisfy their ability to recruit and retain physicians. I think that the economic costs are high, but also the social costs of the inability to recruit and retain are extremely high. For example, the unmet needs that we have when we are unable to recruit, the resource utilization and opportunity costs that we utilize, spending vast amounts of money collectively around the state, all lead to a coordinated system being a good idea. And then also the just the dollar cost, which is estimated to be in the many millions of dollars being spent on recruitment and physicians just in the rural and critical access hospital system. I think that the Representative Nathanson's bill just promotes that materials promoting Oregon as a desirable place to live. I think there are some things that we need to do to make it so, not just say that it's so, and there are certainly some other things going on in bills other than this, but I think the ability to come together as a group, and I also would agree with Dr. Smith that bringing this together under the Workforce Committee of the Oregon Health Policy Board would be the most appropriate place to place it. The AHEC and the Oregon Health Workforce Institute are active partners in that, and that would be an alternative if for some reason you're looking for something outside of government, but I think that that we certainly are active participants in that process through the Workforce Committee.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Greenlee and committee members, thank you for allowing us to present our positions to you today. I am Joe Johnson, and I work with the recruitment and retention issues in the department, or in the department, in the Office of Rural Health. And our office has a legislative mandate to assist rural and underserved communities with healthcare access issues. We approach this from a multitude of ways, but my focus has been since January 2004, focusing solely on recruitment and retention issues. We are the state member for the National Rural Recruitment and Retention Organization, which is a network of nonprofits that focus on fitting the needs of rural communities with the candidates that come looking for rural work. The 3R Net has been our source of candidate, our primary source of candidates for this last 5 or 6 years. And we post all the active opportunities on their website, and this allows us to take advantage of a $40,000 advertising budget where they do the work. They go out and they do the exhibits and make people aware that this site is available for states throughout our nation that are looking for rural and underserved providers. We do charge a nominal fee for the postings, and it's a calendar year fee, so 1 to 2 postings is $500. 9-plus postings is $2,000, and that allows both the small rural health clinics that only need one provider to get their opportunities posted out there for a very low fee, and the others to participate with their greater needs for that $2,000 a year. That they can post provider positions, they can post nursing positions, they can post, you know, whatever they need out on this website. As the recruitment services coordinator, I work with the sites to develop their recruitment retention plans, to look at their communities with the eyes that come from outside that can help them see what's really wonderful about their communities, because when we all know once we get used to looking at something, it just looks like this is just us and this is who we are, but we're able to give them some excitement around what they really do have to offer. We work to develop their marketing from the standpoint of helping them look at their websites to see what somebody else might see if they're looking at a website that somebody's trying to use.
Are you saying this isn't necessary, that you're doing it?
No, I'm saying it's very necessary.
Oh, okay. I was just...
No, this is what it's very necessary. So that we can get the right providers to the sites that are going to fit with the communities to help ensure retention. But we really can't talk about some of these recruitment retention issues without looking at the things that people come here before besides the beautiful scenic territory we've got. We've got we compete not necessarily with practices within Oregon, but with other states throughout the nation. We don't have any state loan repayment to offer people when they're coming out of school with $200,000, $250,000 worth of debt. Our malpractice rates are high, and our malpractice reinsurance program is due to sunset at the end of this year. And that's going to make it difficult to recruit new people and to retain those that we have. And then equally important is the perceived level of our education system, because providers want schools that they will be optimistic that their kids will thrive and do well throughout their lifetimes. So thank you for this opportunity to talk to you, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to respond.
Thank you. Any questions this panel? Thank you very much. And we have Rose Cox, Brian Berenger, and Doug Riggs, and I guess we are getting some time problems, so be helpful if you would speed it up. Who's Doug?
I'll go through them. These guys can start.
Do you want
to go first?
Okay. I'll be very brief. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you so much for having us speak and for hearing this bill, and thank you to Representative Nathanson for bringing House Bill 236. I'm Rose Cox, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the bill in support of the bill on behalf of the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon, or COHO. Very briefly, we believe the timing on this is ideal, particularly around reform. Coordination of these kind of efforts is key, and we do heartily support the bill. COHO believes that Oregon is a special place, and we should bring folks here from all over the country. And just personally, as a recent transplant to Oregon, I personally support the bill as well, and think that the more that we reach out to docs across the country and talk about the special systems that we have here in Oregon, the more folks will want to come.
Great.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm Brian Beringer with the Oregon Medical Association. We also support the bill. I'll be very brief, just to say that this sort of coordination of efforts will, I think, complement some of the recruiting efforts you've already heard that's going on. The story that Representative Nathanson relayed to me that was exciting for us is the idea of bringing in the visitor bureaus and folks like that that could create sort of comprehensive marketing plans. So while we have a number of things going on, the coordination of those things, as well as adding in and pulling in some other folks, we think is a great idea, along with the other things in this building that your committee has heard. We need to obviously support those as well. Support the bill.
Great. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you.
Okay. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2360 and continue on with the public hearing on House Bill House Bill 3580. And we'll ask the two people in the audience who are going to testify to come and testify while we're trying to recruit some phone folks. So that's Tammy Bonney and who's the other?
Louise Grimmer.
Louise Grimmer, right. I see it.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Greenlick and the committee. My name is Louise Grimmer. I'm a volunteer EMT intermediate with Chiloquin Volunteer Ambulance Service, and I'm also employed by Chiloquin Ambulance as an office administrator, and I'm here today to talk to you about the mobile training unit, which I'm very familiar with, not only as using those services as a volunteer EMT, but last year when there was an outcry that both positions would be defunded, I worked on a letter-writing campaign with other rural agencies to try to at least retain one of the mobile training units, which we have done for this year.
Hi, I'm Zach there.
We use the mobile training unit quite a bit in Chiloquin. As a matter of fact, last Thursday, Leslie Huntington, she's an EMT paramedic, and she's based out of the Medford area, came and did a three-hour training with us on pharmaceuticals and their proper use, and for all levels, first responders, EMT basics, intermediates, and paramedics. Her training that she provided and the training that Donna Wilson, who is no longer with the mobile training unit, provided are very essential to rural and frontier areas. if they didn't come and do some of our trainings every year, all we would have to rely on is ourselves and what we could train each other with. They bring in outside information, new state-of-the-art techniques, and when our scope of practice changes, then they can assist us in becoming up to date. You know, one mobile training unit person, I think the gentleman testified that they served over 2,000 or 3,000 EMTs. That's hundreds of thousands of the public that we come in contact with to provide services with on a daily basis. So there's a large trickle-down theory with this one person, maintaining at least the one person, the impact that it'd have, especially on the frontier and rural areas. They do training in the metropolitan areas, but their primary area of work is in the rural area. Last year, we budgeted $6,000 in our volunteer agency. We're a 501c3, and that was for continuing education and certification of new EMTs and recertification of the current EMTs. If user fees were to go up on that, I would speculate that our budget could not withstand that, and we would have to ask our volunteers to pay to volunteer, and there's just a certain amount of ridiculousness in that. The states are mandated to provide EMS service to the counties. The counties are mandated to provide the service. We need help in the rural areas. There's not a lot of us, but we have a huge impact, especially in this day and age when people cannot afford to go to the doctor's often. They wait and they wait and they wait and they wait, and they get sicker and sicker and sicker, and they finally call the ambulance, and we're there, and we need to be able to take care of them in a professional and kindly manner, and we act as a lot of times as the in-between between the doctors and the emergency rooms. People can't afford to go to their doctors, so they call us to take them to the emergency room. The mobile training unit, if it was to disappear, would have a huge impact.
Madam Minister, let's bag the phone witnesses. I'm sorry, go ahead.
The financial impact would be one thing, but also it would lessen the quality of the service that we can provide our communities by making all of our education in-house education, and we wouldn't have the resources available to us to get these outside people to come in and further our education. I wouldn't have become an EMT intermediate had it not been for the mobile training unit. And that's all I have to say today. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
Co-Chair Greenlick and committee members, my name is Tammy Boney. I am the EMS chief in Chiloquin, and as Louise says, we are a very small community.
Sorry, where?
Chiloquin, a very small community out in the rural area, and we do depend on the EMTU unit to come out and for a lot of our trainings. Our people are volunteers, and when I speak of our rural communities, I'm speaking for all of them. These are people who are not paid. They spend their time to serve the communities. And without proper education, it's hard for us to be professional. Just because they're not paid does not mean that they're not professional. And when somebody calls 911 out in the community, they are expecting for trained people in back of an ambulance. And as Louise says, we do our trainings, but to keep up on date on those trainings cost money, and those EMT units, that's where Leslie has come in, and Donna in the past have come to our aid in those trainings and those techniques and bring the equipment and training us on it. And it is so important for to keep those people up in their skills. So I am asking you guys to please support this and find the money in the general fund and keep, you know, help those people out in those communities. These are your families out there, not just here in the city. There are people out there.
Darn right.
Mm-hmm. That's
Thank
all
you.
I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Barres?
Marisi, yes.
Marisi, I'm sorry.
No problem.
Would you introduce yourself? And
Yeah, my name is Zach Barisi. I'm with Boardman Fire, right at the ambulance in Morrill County for Morrill County Health District. As an EMT intermediate, kind of in limbo, finished my paramedic and trying to get my Oregon paramedic card. So shall I just go ahead?
Yes,
go ahead.
Please. You're up if you take a couple
Great.
Minutes.
Great. Thank you. I just wanted to voice my opinion of how valuable the mobile training units are. We're in rural eastern Oregon, not quite frontier Oregon, but I'm the training officer of our fire department, and we've had the mobile training units here when we don't have the capabilities to do trainings on new equipment or new procedures, like AHA updates. The mobile training unit has filled that for us. And the people who've come down with the mobile training unit, their the professionalism, level of expertise, all that is second to none. We can provide some training in-house. We don't have access to a lot of things. We've got a very, very small budget. We can't purchase new training equipment. We can't hire someone out of house to come in and do the training. Even if we were to be able to buy, let's say on a grant, some new equipment, may not have enough for the training equipment to go along with that and to keep skills proficient. And in that gap for us is where the mobile training unit has come in and really shined for us and been, an invaluable resource. I understand with the budget cuts, there's much less availability for it. So I'm not sure we expect to actually see them come around. But if we can ever get them, it's always a big plus for us. And I would certainly hope that the funding is kept for the mobile training unit. As for rural and frontier Oregon, it's invaluable. We don't have neighbors with a lot of money that can come and bail us out when we don't have the money to train our own personnel, and we can't really rely on anyone else to do it for us. So it's either us and our limited budget or the mobile training unit.
I think you're gonna find strong support for the opportunity. The question is, how are we gonna pay for it? That's gonna be some discussion, but I really do appreciate your testimony.
Yeah, and as a resident of Oregon, I have my own personal views, as to funding, and I know it's difficult. I know it's not a magic button you can hit and say, hey, we want funding for this, and poof, it's there. I know there's tough decisions to be made. I certainly don't envy anyone having to make those decisions. But as far as looking at information as to, what the value is of what you get for your money, the mobile training unit certainly has, as far as I'm concerned, one of the highest values as far as emergency services goes in the state of Oregon.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony. It's on our mind.
I appreciate the chance to talk. I really do. So thank you for the invitation and the chance to talk. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you guys very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
There are two more people who want to get on the phone. We're having trouble organizing it, but I think we'll keep this hearing open, move on to the next public hearing as well.
Thank you.
And try and get the other two folks as we get them one at a time. Thank you very much for coming.
And Rep. Corn's coming right in the back door.
Okay. Keep this public hearing open. You hang that up.
Yeah.
And why don't you get the next one? Tell them.
Okay. Well, let's just.
And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2944 and ask Representative Clem, who actually gave all the interesting piece to a Senate committee on this, so I don't know. We're second in line. Representative Clem, welcome.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Clem, and I'm a state representative from here in Salem, District 21. And I bring to you House Bill 2944, though I've discovered
Clem, you want to join us?
The amendments that we were interested in having ready aren't ready for you. So I can verbally describe them to see if they would be of interest. And I'm not going to go through the entire spiel that I did with the Senate committee, but I will briefly summarize in case you haven't read the newspaper article on the front page of the Metro section of the Oregonian and on a variety of internet sites, both national and local. We had a problem in my family where my mother-in-law was believed to have died by her insurance company, and she didn't. And it could have been resolved, I felt, if a notice had been sent of cancellation or something, so we would have known that they had falsely attached a death phone call notification to her record instead of whoever had actually died. And, you know, we unfortunately didn't find it out for many months, and this is still ongoing, you know, 6 years later, trying to resolve the situation. But this is designed to have this not happen to other people again. And what I understand from talking with the company involved, at some points, death certificates are required in, you know, insurance history, and other times it got awkward because people felt like you were, you know, someone's calling to say that their family member passed away, and then if you say, "We'll prove it, send us a death certificate," sometimes that's very awkward as well in terms of, you know, why would I lie about this? I had a tragedy. So, and at least with the company she was with, they had stopped asking for death certificates. And in this case, there was originally a dispute over whether notification had been sent. I believe now it's clear there was no notification sent on the policy in question. So what I did was asked legislative counsel to draft up something that would require notification upon cancellation of someone's policy. And they referred me back to a point in the statute where that's already required, actually, that there is a separate notice to policyholder required before a group or individual health insurance policy if the reason is non-payment of premium, but not if it's death or, in this case, false death, or some other reason that somebody might be canceled. So my review of the statutes over on the just before, that's 743565, over in 743560 in the group health insurance statute, there is a discussion of what happens when you're going to cancel a group policy. And my offering is that it would make sense to just have that same thing apply to all policies, not just group. And what it says is that there's a cancellation form that is prescribed by DCBS, and it explains the rights for COBRA and, you know, what you might do if you want to keep a policy. Must be given by mail and must be mailed not later than 10 working days after which the policy is terminated. And then if the insurer fails to give notice, then the insurer shall continue the policy in full force from the date the notice should have been provided until the date the notice is received, and shall waive the premiums owed for the period under that section. So that way it's on the insurer to say we're canceling your policy, and that person then has gotten notice, and they would need to figure out, oh, did I not pay, or, you know, whatever the reasons are, someone might get canceled. Now, I'll tell you, LC also put in here something that's required under federal law, and maybe your committee is already reviewing this, but the new Federal Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act has some grounds for rescission that are required, and this is a vehicle as an opportunity to implement those requirements, since I probably had the right relating clause. So if you're trying to read the bill and not all of it seems to be about notification, some is about rescission, that's because of a need to match up with federal law. I would certainly be happy to answer any questions. I don't want to belabor the whole story all over again, but it was not a pleasant situation. It's very unfortunate. We think this is a way to go about solving things like this from ever happening in the first place, where a family, even though it's awkward, would get a letter saying, our condolences, we're sorry to hear that you lost a family member, as a courtesy notification, you know, we're going to be canceling that policy since we assume you obviously don't need it anymore. And then if the person reads it and says, well, I'm not dead, then they can write back in and deal with it, which was what would have been nice in our situation.
Can I just say your situation, you found it out when there was a claim for that and the claim was rejected?
Yeah, so Mr. Chair, 9 months later, my mother-in-law was coming home from the Grange and got into an auto accident, fractured the vertebrae in her neck, got sent to Portland in an ambulance, and when we tried to access her insurance benefits, found out that she was believed to have died a year earlier than that. And obviously she wasn't, passed away at that point and isn't still. She's still healthy, and so that's when we uncovered it. But, you know, the issue for us was...
How long did it take to get the claim paid?
Mr. Chair, the claim's never been paid. So the issue for us was... If there had been some sort of notification, I think we could have caught it. Or, and this was the point of the person on the other end of the phone line originally, you know, didn't you notice that the premiums weren't coming out of her account anymore? Well, the problem was she had been overcharged far more than the value of what a supplemental plan would be in the first month. So we thought she was just getting overcharged. And so she got a refund of that. And but apparently in her insurance provider's mind, the reason for the refund was that she had died, not that they had overcharged her. And so we saw a check get refunded, and we're like, okay, good, she got her money back. And then, frankly, I don't pour through her checkbook looking at every single auto pay to see if $50 got brought out that month. And she has several accounts that her husband had set up. He had only died 4 months before this whole thing happened. And she had not... learned, I don't even know if she knew what auto pay was, to be honest. You know, he handled all of that, and she didn't notice that the money wasn't coming out of one of her accounts because there were a number of them. And we were trying to consolidate all her accounts at this time for estate tax and other reasons, and she didn't see them coming out, and we didn't, you know, she had a card that was valid in our minds, but because it had never been canceled, we thought it was valid. And it wasn't valid because she had been canceled apparently without notification quite some time earlier.
And is this coming through the Senate? Should we wait for that, or should we?
It's a different bill. You know, that bill would say that, you know, and again, none of this stuff will apply to her situation, but what that bill would do is say that if somebody feels aggrieved by their insurance company, they would have the option to get an attorney, which you can do now, but you can't get your attorney fees paid for. So you can just get the benefits that you were owed minus whatever attorney fees, which, you know, our feeling was that you should be able to get your attorney fees and your expenses. And so that's that bill, but this is really more about the notification to try and resolve it so it doesn't get to the lawyer part, because we never retained an attorney because we're not sue happy people. Although it has been maddening, I can tell you, for 6 years trying to resolve this.
Are there other questions? Mm-hmm. Sir? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes. Isn't there a DCBS route for complaints? Or I know asking if a government agency is going to help you is tenuous, but...
Mr. Chair, there is, and I pursued it multiple times. Repeated pushback on my part, asking for assistance, making counter-arguments, and in the end, I was told there's nothing we can do in the statutes. We have no tool to help you prove that your mother-in-law, you know, wasn't dead and get relief. I mean, they could obviously send a letter saying she's not dead, can you do anything? But because the insurer didn't want to do anything at that point about it, they told me they have no tools to force them to. And I questioned that and whether, you know, really fining or don't you have anything? And there's things like not allow them to do business at all of the state anymore, but I didn't feel that was appropriate over this one issue myself. So I was told get an attorney in the end. And, you know, in writing the last letter I had said, you know, encourage you to hand this over to an attorney. Well, again, I didn't really want to have to pay the legal fees out of her amount that she was owed for her medical bills. So she just paid it all out of pocket herself whatever her auto insurance and Medicare didn't cover, she just paid it. And she'd been with the company 31 years at this point.
Mr. Holt.
For the record, I'm Tom Holt with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Here about House Bill 2944 and look forward to seeing Representative Clem's amendments and being able to work with him on those. What I thought I would do today is just give you a little bit of an overview of what we do today as a matter of process and is probably common amongst most carriers, and to give you some idea of the scale. Yes, very briefly. Generally when a member is going to discontinue coverage, they do get a letter, and if there are any dependents on the policy, those dependents also get a letter, which includes information about where to go to continue coverage, in case it's an error of some kind, you know, who to call, and what their rights are with COBRA and other kinds of ways to continue their coverage. And it also comes then with what's technically called a certificate of coverage, which a member may need to prove that they have been continuously insured if they're going to another company. When a member passes away, we do not send letters because our members have told us that they don't need us to tell them that, you know, a member of their family has died, and that it just, you know, it was based on that kind of feedback that we discontinued doing that. When it's appropriate, refunds are issued to the members on a prorated basis as appropriate. And to give you some idea of scale, you know, we have about 750,000 members right now. I got numbers on 2010, and just in the individual market, we had just over 60,000 changes in policies. The vast majority of those were really internal to us. They were people moving from one region's policy to another, often because people are changing the benefit design that they're choosing. We had a bit over 5,000 who were people who actually made a request specifically to discontinue with our company and probably go somewhere else, and less than 1,000 that were members who deceased. Then we had a few thousand, between 2,000 and 3,000, who were discontinued for non-payment of premium. And when those people encounter a problem in paying the premium, you know, as you would expect of any organization that's trying to collect a bill, they will get multiple notices that they're behind and then eventually, you know, need to be discontinued. A lot of the refund checks that we end up issuing are when people have tried to pay a part of a premium but haven't been able to pay the whole premium, and so then we refund whatever portion they had tried to pay, but they couldn't meet the requirements of their contract, so we make them whole in terms of giving them a refund. So the one, in terms of the bill as presented, the certified mail part would cause us a lot of concern because there is no real way to automate that at all. The certified mail has to be filled out by hand, to do that many thousands of times in the course of a year will be very costly, but we think there are probably other ways that we can get at the goal that Representative Clem seeks in the bill. And he referenced that there are some federal requirements embedded in the bill for conformance, and those are good. There's a new federal requirement that notices be given, you know, 30 days in advance of the rescission. Where we have some timelines, I think, as little as 10 days right now in Oregon law. So we'll be, that language just syncs up Oregon statute with the federal statute.
You'll be working with Representative Clem on.
That's our intention, sir.
That's great. Any questions? Okay, thank you both very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2944, and open a public hearing on House Bill 3230.
Okay.
No. Yeah, no. Let's do this first. Not yet.
Okay.
Want to tell us about 3230?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3230 increases the penalty for practicing dentistry without a license to 5 years imprisonment and $125,000 fine or both. And we have couple of folks ready to testify, and this is brought before the committee at the request of Representative Hoyle by the Oregon Dental Association.
Okay, who we got?
We saw St. Patrick Brock. And Representative Hoyle.
Representative Hoyle, will you start?
Patrick.
Yep. We'll have Daniel Saucy, is that? Patrick Rush. Did I get Daniel's name right?
Saucy.
Okay.
We'll put you in the middle.
I just always go to the left.
Let's kill this.
Hey, co-chairs, member of the committee, members of the committee. This is a very, Val Hoyle, I represent West Eugene, Junction City, Cheshire and Alvador, and thank you very much for hearing this testimony today. This is a very simple bill. What this would do is to make practicing dentistry without a license a felony instead of a misdemeanor. Practicing medicine without a license is a felony, and it would allow us to have prosecution for people who decide to practice dentistry without a license. I think one of the more extreme cases was in Gresham, where for 10 years a man practiced dentistry without a license, but because this was a misdemeanor, it never rose to the level where the police felt like they could really do anything about it. The man did end up getting charged not with practicing dentistry without a license, but for shooting one of his patients, and so he got charged with murder. And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not saying it would have prevented this, but this was someone who should...
Licensure would have prevented that, I presume, yes.
You know, I am sure that these good people would not have given that person a license.
My goodness, would not shoot me.
At the end of the day, we had no means, when we saw for 10 years running that this man was sending people out with infections, with pain, not treating them well, there was no means for us to prosecute this person. This is... medical care, that we should have parity and equity in how we treat people that treat without a license, and I would hope that we could pass this bill.
I don't understand why you couldn't be prosecuted for a misdemeanor.
Well, you could be, but it just doesn't rise to, you know, when you have police departments and they have a number of crimes in front of them, prosecuting for a misdemeanor is a slap on the wrist, if they get prosecuted at all. But a felony is a much more serious crime, and we would be able to level a higher fine. Patrick, did you?
Sure. Good afternoon, co-chairs. Greenlick and Thompson, and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Dan Saucy. I'm a general dentist here in Salem, and I'm the chair of the Government Relations Council for the Oregon Dental Association, and I'm here today to support House Bill 3230, which increases the penalty for practicing dentistry without a license from misdemeanor to a felony. We've covered quite a bit of the issue, but a little more on that Gresham cat. The man had previously been caught performing dentistry without a license in Salem in 2000, and the criminal had slipped away. The board had done everything in its current power, obtained an injunction against the offender, ordering him to stop practicing dentistry. And when the state law enforcement went to seize the dental equipment at his home, it had been cleared out, and the man had vanished. Cases of unlicensed dentistry all too often don't come to light until a patient, often a recent immigrant, walks into a hospital with a potentially life-threatening infection because the current practice is just a misdemeanor. Law enforcement considers it a lower priority. Unlicensed practice of medicine, a similar crime, is a felony. This bill would make practicing without a license the same for dentistry. In changing the classification from misdemeanor to felony, it's our hope that people will think twice before putting patients in danger. And it will not only give the Board of Dentistry the ability to charge these offenders with punishments more fitting their crime, but will move the importance of such investigations up for police departments. This is not just a problem in Oregon. In February 2011, an unlicensed dentist was charged in Virginia with at least two victims. In Gwinnett County, outside of Atlanta, a man was charged after a 20-year-old was treated by a man who was treated by a man became suspicious of the basement operation and told his parents, who then contacted the police. And a Chesterfield County, Virginia man accused of practicing dentistry without a license has been performing invasive dental procedures illegally since 2005. We must do what we can do to protect the citizens of Oregon from unlicensed dentists. I urge your support of House Bill.
Those two cases, both felonies in those states?
I cannot answer that, no. And there's another couple of cases listed behind, but outside the...
Thank you, co-chairs. My name is Patrick Bratz. I'm the executive director of the Board of Dentistry. This is an issue that has come before the board a number of times, at least in my tenure with the board of 8 years. We've had at least four cases that we've worked on and investigated. As Representative Hoyle mentioned, this doesn't fall very high on the radar of district attorneys or police departments when it's not a felony. The case in question regarding the Gresham dentist, and I know we all chuckled about, you know, when I came back from my office today and found out the person had been killed, someone had been killed in a dental office, I said I didn't think a 357 was part of the tools that were normally used. There was some other incidents, but the person...
Anesthesia.
There you go. Yeah. There were some other issues, but he was there for a dental appointment. We were watching him. We had been working with the police departments. We were ready to go, but again, all we can do is order an injunction, and that's no good than a piece of paper. We can take into court and try to have a judge file it, but it may not happen. The police just said, listen, we're too busy. We can't do this. We've had a couple of other cases. One was in Washington County where we had a dentist, again, as Dr. Saucy mentioned. We didn't find out about this until the patient showed up in the hospital with an infection that almost killed her. She was very hesitant to come forward. We were able to get her to come forward. We got Washington County involved, but because the dentist had done some weird prescribing, they went after her under the Medical Practices Act. They issued a grand jury subpoena. They issued grand jury papers, but by the time they got ready to serve them, she'd fled the country. This person had a practice of almost 500 to 1,000 patients. When we went to investigate her home, she'd been doing a lot of extensive work with these individuals and had no license. This will allow, when we get these kind of complaints, we can take them to the police departments and the district attorneys, and they can file them as felonies, and will help in the prosecution of this, because it is a problem. I'm sure there are today some people in certain parts of Portland practicing dentistry without a license. We just haven't found out about it because someone hasn't been harmed. But when we do, we really, from the board standpoint, don't have a lot to do. If Dr. Saucy does something wrong, we have a lot to do. He has a license. We can take that license away from him. We can let the public know he no longer has a license, which would be a big detriment to his practice. But someone that doesn't have a license, we don't have much to do to them.
Are there any questions?
Well, I just have a sense of dis-ease. I mean, let's take either of those. You think they've read the law and know they were only violating a misdemeanor? I mean, you think if it was a felony, it would have prevented them from doing what they did?
No.
The second time on that fellow from Gresham, I think he would have been hooked up in year 2000 instead of 2010.
What's the penalty under the under the misdemeanor?
I don't know.
Is it prison?
No. It's a small fine.
Small fine.
Get that information back to you certainly, but it is a small fine.
Yeah. And the problem is it's getting them prosecuted. I mean, Chair Greenlee, it's the district attorneys won't even file the cases. And I'm not picking on district attorneys. I like district attorneys. It's just they've got so much on their docket. It's not worth it to them to file a misdemeanor charge. It is for a felony.
It seems like it's practicing medicine without a license. It's practicing dentistry, which is actually cutting hard and soft tissue without a license.
Well, it sounds like assault and battery, for one thing.
I think at the end of the day, this is not one of those... this bill is not going to prevent people from practicing dentistry without a license. Maybe they'll find out about it. Maybe a few of them won't do it. But we will have some tools so that when people do this, we can actually prosecute them and maybe stop them from doing it in the future and harming more people. So it's just allowing the board to have the similar tools that the medical board does. It's a simple bill.
Mr. Chair, and just if I might add, I think sometimes, and we kind of chuckled even about the dentist out in Gresham, but this is part of the medical profession. There is tremendous chance for infection. I've had people I had a friend of mine whose father, they literally called up and said, this guy's on his deathbed, you better come sit, you know, say goodbye to your father for the last time. He ended up, it was a tooth. And so I think that the dentistry profession, it is part of the medical profession. It is as equal with medical doctors. It is something that I think we really need to take a serious look at. So.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3230 and close the public hearing on House Bill 3580. And one tomorrow at 8:30, is that right? Is there anything else to come before the committee?
We want more.
You can.
You announced that you were carrying it over, Mr. Chair. Does that mean you want to schedule 2174 on Wednesday as a carryover or at a later date?
Can we talk about tomorrow? We'll carry it over till Wednesday,
okay.
And then we'll decide.
Thank you.
Anything else? Good job, guys. Long
Thank
session.
You.
We are adjourned.